So for the teaching, I chose Lungpo Liam because just living with Lungpo Liam, I always thought he was a throwback to a previous age, like the older Krupa Ajahns, and he made me think of Ajahn Sao. I had heard in a story of Ajahn Sao, he liked to build things and putter around the monastery, fixing things and whatnot, and that Lungpo Liam very much has that temperament as well. And he's also one of the few senior Wat Phapong monks, the only one I can think of who doesn't own a personal cell phone. So he's very much a throwback to a previous age. So this is called Watch Your Mind and Escape Mara's Snare. It's a Dhamma talk given to the monks and novices of Wat Phapong in 1991, relating Lungpo Liam's experiences in his first year practicing at Wat Phapong with Ajahn Chah in 1969. The principal teachings of the Lord Buddha are indeed vast. Let us simply see them all as skillful means or tools for practice. In my case, I was fortunate to be able to rely on the spiritual qualities, the parami, of our venerated teacher, Lungpo Chah, from the year 1969 onwards. This was the year I entrusted myself to become his disciple. When one is too weak to be self-reliant and does not have enough mental energy to help oneself, one needs to find someone to lean on. So I came to fully rely on Ajahn Chah in that year, not only relying on the teachings and advice he gave, but also on the place that he maintained in order for us to be inspired and motivated in our practice. I joined in for the rains retreat at that time, having come from a rather troublesome search with many obstacles. I had been on a quite unsatisfactory journey without a clear destination and was now really trying to change my direction to be in line with the principles of the Buddha's teachings. I had been looking for Krupa Ajahns in many places with the question of what I truly wanted to do with my life. I had seen quite a bit of the life of people in the world with my own relatives. They kept getting involved with the same old things over and over, and I couldn't see anything getting better. Seeing that the circumstances of their lives were rather confused and that there was a lot of delusion involved, I realized that I should try to lead the life of a monk in order to eventually put an end to such conditions. So I tried to find a teacher, a master, or at least study the various methods that were generally available in the communities I lived in. Together with my monastic friends, I started studying the scriptures, especially the Abhidhamma, and gained some knowledge in this field. Because the Abhidhamma is based on clear principles and facts, its structure and outline lends itself to study. Having studied it, one can easily speak about it. But although I was able to speak on Abhidhamma, for myself, I still felt utterly confused and stuck in a state that was not at all free. My studies left me feeling unfocused and depleted of energy, so I decided that this was not in keeping with my aspirations, and I came here to Ubon Province. Before that, I had gone to train in the monastery of Ajahn Mi in Wat Pa Sungnan. He was a meditation monk, but already quite old. When I arrived in his monastery in Korat Province, he told me that his strongly deteriorating physical condition wouldn't permit him to teach. I should search for some other place where, perhaps, I could meet a suitable teacher. I stayed with him for a while, but after a short time I returned to Ubon. Coming here, I heard about Lungpo Cha's reputation and wanted to have a look at his monastery. When I visited Ajahn Chah for the first time and paid respects, I saw the monastery with its rules of conduct and was very pleased and inspired. I thought, these are really the correct standards of practice. So I returned to my former teacher to take leave and handed my duties back to him so that he wouldn't have to worry any further what I was doing. He issued a letter transferring me to Ajahn Chah as evidence that I wasn't a vagabond trying to run away after some inappropriate action. Ajahn Chah said, "Let's see first. You have come with the wish to practice, so see how it goes with the practice. We don't know each other. I don't know who you are or if you have any problems." But he let me stay and arranged a kuti for me. so I had a place to stay that provided shelter from the sun and the rain. It was very far away from the others, though. There was no bathroom, and when I needed to go to the toilet, I had to walk quite far. At that time, in Wat Nong Papong, there weren't many toilets at all, only two or three for all 40 of the monks and novices. In that year, if I remember correctly, there were 47 monks who spent the rains retreat at Wat Nong Papong, and I didn't know anyone. I wasn't interested in anyone. I assumed that all these monks had come to do what they had to do in their practice by themselves, so I took no interest in them. I didn't even know their names. I really wasn't interested. All I was interested in was my own tasks and duties, the ways of practice, and the observances. This is what I felt inspiration for and was motivated to do. When the time to enter the rains retreat came, Ajahn Chah gave advice and teachings to guide us in our practice. All the monks were keen on developing their conduct and changing their habits. Ajahn Chah had us work on ourselves through performing our duties and communal obligations. He had us do various chores and practices. In those days in Wat Papong, on the 7th and 14th day of the lunar cycle, all the leaves were to be swept. Sweeping was one of the obligations that you couldn't miss. We had to finish within 2 hours. Actually, the area wasn't as big as it is today, only about the area in front of our present sala. We merely swept the sala area up to the ordination hall. There weren't many trees and only small ones, so it was finished quickly. There was a bell at 4 in the afternoon for the monks and novices to come together for meditation. Usually, for the meditation sessions, Ajahn Chah would come 30 minutes or an hour earlier to sit. I saw the meditation sittings as something I was happy to do. I was well motivated to sit, as I had already been practicing meditation before, once a day for at least an hour or a little more. So I sat. I sat, but I didn't get much out of it because my mind was usually in a state where it liked to proliferate. It never settled in itself and kept producing thoughts all the time. Still, most of the time, I came to the sala before the others. There was another monk, Ajahn Mahasamran, who came at the same time that I did. The two of us started sitting early, regularly. Ajahn Mahasamran came roughly 15 or 20 minutes before the bell, and I practiced the same way, continuously. It was good to sit ahead of the bell. There weren't any further duties to do, so from the time we started sitting, around 4 or 4:30, until the beginning of the evening chanting, we had more than 2 hours, which was just right. The sitting sometimes hurt a little, but I didn't pay attention. I was only interested in keeping on training myself all the time. I never had any interest when the occasional sweet hot drinks or herbal medicines like samaw or makampom were offered. These things stimulate one's bowels, and to have to go to the toilet at night could cause quite a bit of inconvenience. So I felt no need to take anything like that, so I didn't join the others when they had them. After evening chanting, I went straight back to my kuti. I didn't have much contact with my friends in the monastic life. Not really wanting it, I'd think, I'd rather go back to my kuti, the dwelling place that I had been assigned. I never went to other places, such as the kutis of other monks. I simply stayed at my kuti. When I left the kuti, it was to walk to the sala. When I left the sala, it was to walk to my kuti. Except for going to the toilet or cleaning it, this was all I did in my daily routine. It was good that I didn't speak with the other monks. In return, they didn't start chatting with me. This created a sense of being free. I cut off the problems that can come from socializing with others. Nobody came after me, and I had the chance to do my practice on my own. The daily chores of cleaning and maintaining the monastic dwellings were usually done after returning from the dining hall. The meal was over at about 10 in the morning. Returning to my kuti right after finishing in the dining hall and starting to clean it was a nice and relaxing change. It helps to overcome the usual drowsiness after having eaten. Actually, I didn't eat as much as the others, and I was usually finished ahead of them. I found that eating a lot would give rise to the typical hindrances to one's awareness that arise in meditation, nivarana. One would feel sluggish and inert through the day. so I ate just enough to be able to keep my body going. Thus one then feels light, at ease, and energetic. I tried to keep the maintenance of my dwelling up to the standards laid down in the monastic rules, but no more. I kept a kettle filled with drinking water. I had one spittoon, my robes, and my bowl. That was all. In those days, not much development had taken place in terms of roads or traffic. All there was the sound of a regular pickup truck passing Banglang village around 2 or 3 in the morning. This was the sign to get up. Alarm clocks weren't available. Having no alarm clocks, the monks would develop a sense of constant alertness. They needed to listen to the sounds of animals, like the forest chicken or night owls, to tell the time. Sometimes one would get the time wrong. Thinking it was 3 in the morning, one would get up at 2 or 1. One would then simply continue and not go back to sleep. This created a sense of diligence in the practice and supported the spirit of the monastic life, where one needs to be in control of one's mind day and night. Though I did all these things from time to time, I was still insecure, and worries and critical thoughts would come up. When one lacks experience, these things can happen. If I let my awareness slip, feelings of insufficiency would arise. So before going to sleep, I would firmly establish mindfulness and prepare myself for waking. Whenever I became aware of waking, I would immediately get up. I found this to be a really good practice. It makes you independent from clocks. You need to maintain the simple feeling of being ready to do things at the appropriate time, straight away, without preferences. Each day I spent at least an hour or an hour and a half doing walking meditation. Referring to the sunlight, I'd stop only when my shadow was directly over my feet. Practices like this made me feel motivated to keep up the training observances, my personal daily practices, and the monastery schedule all by myself. After having practiced for some time in Wat Bapong like this, one day I heard Lungpo Cha give a Dhamma talk on the 3 characteristics, impermanence, anicchang, unsatisfactoriness, dukkang, and not-self, anatta. He emphasized contemplating the 3 characteristics because he found that they counteract the 3 vipalasa dhammas, distortions of perception, thought, and views, and the misjudgments that can come up in meditation when one has nimittas or visions. Nimittas can confuse people and lead them into delusion and can have them deviate from the teachings and lose the correct path. Lungpo Cha gave advice on this for more than an hour, and when we dispersed after 8 in the evening, I was thinking to myself, the 3 characteristics are good principles to take as one's foundation. They are a good basis. No matter what happens, I will ground my attitude in the 3 characteristics. So I made a firm determination to practice meditation unremittingly. After the daily chores, when it was time to come together, I meditated. Back at my kuti, I put down my personal things and I meditated. A good sense of seclusion developed. When there were sounds, I heard them, taking them merely as sounds. The usual emotional reactions ceased to proliferate, and there was a sense of nothing being there. This is how the experience felt. Mindfulness, in the sense of an awareness that there are things happening according to causes and conditions, was, however, present. But I kept myself established in the thought that this experience is not a sure one. There may be changes. Other experiences may come up. This is the attitude I mindfully upheld. Regarding the daily routine, when I was going to rest or to sleep, I determined to do just that. But whenever the time was ripe to get up again, I would immediately get up. At one point, I made a specific practice of alternating the time for going to sleep. Being used to going to sleep at 10 p.m., I would move the time to, say, around 8 p.m., and then would get up again at 11 p.m. or 1 a.m. Or sometimes I would take 1 a.m. as the time to go to sleep, and then wake up again at 3 a.m. I trained to surrender again and again, not to get stuck in a pattern, not to get used to having a rest or deriving happiness out of sleep, not even allowing the excuse that this practice was ruining my health. I had my thoughts about this and practiced accordingly until I felt determined in myself to such an extent that I was able to say, Today I'll sleep 2 or 3 hours and not overstep the set time by even 10 or 20 minutes. Most of the time it ended up being within about 5 minutes of the set time. This was a good thing to do. To train oneself like this is for the sake of feeling wide awake in the practice. In fact, in that year, things went very smoothly. I was able to do all these things without much concern for the external world. Even regarding people that I had known closely before, my relatives or friends, I didn't experience symptoms of wanting to relate to or even think of them. I was as unconcerned as a person who has no relatives, no friends, no mother or father, like someone who has nothing left in this world and simply exists, relying solely on himself the whole time. I don't know how these worries fell away to the point of being distant memories, but it was a good opportunity to train entirely by myself, day and night, so I kept doing this. I didn't have much opportunity to go to Lungpo Cha's Kuti. Usually, after the evening chanting was finished, some of the monks and novices would go to Lungpo's Kuti and pay respects to him. There were times that he would even inquire where I was, but still I never went. I saw that most of the time, the reasons for monks to go was to get some contact and be close to him. I didn't think that that was right. I thought the correct way to be close to Lungpo means to take on his standards of conduct and practice. So I really didn't go and see him very much. Sometimes he would ask, "Where did that monk that came from somewhere else go? I never see him here." He asked, but I didn't go and seek contact with him. Rather, I relied on my own motivation to practice, asking myself, "Why did I come here? What do I really want? Do I want friendship or closeness to a teacher?" In fact, I came because I wanted to practice. The place here is supportive of seclusion in every way, so I should go ahead practicing that way. If anybody says I'm unfriendly, I don't mind. I just understand that to practice in this way is an obligation, a duty that we need to fulfill. That's what all of us wanted to do in the first place anyway. My practice developed steadily throughout the second and third month of the rains retreat. With the beginning of the second month, some of the things that occurred seemed quite good. Good here means some parts good and others not so good. I noticed in myself that sometimes I felt good about things and sometimes not. So I asked myself, why are there always these states of good and bad? I posed this question to myself and realized it's because if one likes things being a certain way, one calls them good, and if one doesn't, one calls them bad. Are only the things one likes right and all the others wrong? What I did was question and investigate myself in order to get to know what desire really was. The ways desires express themselves are characterized by these feelings of good and bad. Feelings of good and bad arise from wanting. So I concluded, why bother with these feelings of good and bad? One should take the attitude of not getting involved with these things at all. What one should really take on is the practice of simply having mindfulness in and of itself. So this was the motto I upheld and kept putting into practice. At the beginning of the second month, all my experiences were falling into place. I saw my own mental attitudes and knew the state of mind I was in, both the good states of mind and the bad ones. I saw the states of mind in relation to the mind and saw the mind in relation to the states of mind. In this manner, I saw that the mind was one thing and the states of mind were another. Being able to distinguish the way one feels, separating states of mind from that which is the mind, and in this way, knowing and seeing one's mind and one's states of mind as separate, one sees, quote, the one who knows, unquote, sees the one who knows the mind and who knows the states of mind. This made me experience everything that was happening in a wakeful manner, feeling aware and alert, both when I was sleeping and awake. I was witnessing my own experience all by myself. It was not as if I were escaping to some other place or being aloof, but instead I was following up on things all the time, both the good experiences and the bad ones. That's the way I saw it. I didn't see this experience as anything particularly good. I simply understood it as something I did that was good enough for keeping myself alert. That was all. This experience reminded me of a passage of Dhamma. It made a strong impression on me when I studied for the Nuktam, the Dhamma study exams. I have frequently mentioned it to you in the past. I learned many other passages, but this one I remember particularly well. It comes easily to mind. Quote, "Whoever watches his mind will be freed from Mara's snare." Unquote. How does one become free from Mara's snare? By watching the mind. This is exactly what I thought, so I established my mindfulness in the observation of the modes of what I was feeling. At the same time, I continued to give attention to a samadhi object of meditation. It's not that I neglected this. It is necessary to hold on to a samadhi object as well. I didn't seek for anything more distant than the in-and-out breath. To watch the breath has an impact on the mind. It enables it to overcome defilements and cravings. I observed the samadhi object, and I observed the modes of mind, both unwholesome and wholesome. Knowing the samadhi object and the modes of the mind. These two were joined together and didn't separate, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down. There was the experience of awareness all the time. Sometimes there were states of depression and discouragement. This was also part of the experience. I thought, not facing any obstacles is impossible in this world. One cannot have everything go smoothly all the time. One has to bear with these obstacles. Whatever happens, one has to endure and pull oneself together. There is no way. There is no other way. So I tried to be aware of this and patiently endure things. Sometimes I was overcome by the hindrances. They were quite strong. If one were to give a comparison, it was like being a football that is kicked around. When kicked hard, it shoots off quickly. I couldn't pin it down. The mind kept proliferating here and there, thinking about business, the chores, going on alms round. The mind was in such a state, but I actually didn't make much of it. I just saw that this is how it feels, and upheld that these are all just states of the mind that arise, stay a while, then cease. I saw it as an experience, a symptom that the mind displays. Seeing how this feels in the mind, I thought, this is what the Buddha actually meant when he said, the mind is like that. It has to express good and bad. One can't blame it for this. One can't say that it's all bad, and one can't say that it's all good. So I continued observing these things mindfully. If something came up that was really beyond my capacity to endure, I thought, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta again. If one can't fight it anymore, one just tells oneself, anicca, dukkha, anatta, and lets go of it all, letting it be. So this is what I did. Sometimes it was good, in that a feeling of inspiration and having patient endurance would arise from time to time. But I didn't make anything of it. I just considered that this was part of the back and forth of the struggle between coping and not coping. Then, after maintaining this practice for a continuous period, constantly and unremittingly, the various conditions eventually started making sense. Sometimes I had strong feelings of pitti, rapture and bliss, regardless of whether I was walking, sitting, or lying down. I was aware that this didn't really mean much, even though it could be all day and night that I was in this mode of pitti, feeling very happy, whether walking, sitting, or lying down. I don't think I was misguided by these feelings of happiness. I kept establishing mindfulness in myself, and, just like Lungpo had said in his Dhamma talks, I directed my mindfulness towards the principles of the three characteristics. I had a good memory and could easily recall these teachings. They were also part of what I had memorized in the context of my Dhamma studies and Abhidhamma. I sensed that these were really the principles to take on as one's reference point, the ground to stand on when battling with such experiences. So I used these principles of the three characteristics as the criteria for gauging the happiness one feels within such an experience. I also told myself that happiness is merely happiness. It is a condition that is subject to change. During this period, mind states that are aroused by sensuality and triggered by contact with the senses didn't arise. They didn't occur. It was just like a tree standing still without the wind moving it, absolutely quiet in itself. The eyes were merely eyes and the ears were merely ears, the waves of sensuality having no impact on them. I took them as specific modes of the mind, and I didn't react strongly towards them or give particular importance to their features. I kept practicing like this, but not without sometimes having a rest. But whenever I rested, it actually felt like I wasn't resting. I was in a state of readiness all the time. I continued to practice like this. Eventually, the happiness that I experienced when the mind was in this state for days also changed. Sometimes there was no feeling at all, and I thought, this could point towards liberation. It then turned towards suffering and having feelings of depression, where everything seemed black, like when one travels in the darkness and can't see one's way. But I maintained awareness. Simply that. There was suffering, whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down. I don't know where it all came from or why it was happening, but I kept asking, what is this suffering? Eventually, applying the principle that I had used before with the experience of happiness, I thought, this feeling of suffering has arisen, so it must also cease. Thinking in these terms, I was mindful of these conditions for a day or two, and then it was over. I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry, so I took it as an experience by itself, just part of the to and fro of the struggle for power. So I practiced with it. I didn't let go of the monastic routine and daily personal duties and chores. I took them as my refuge. Continuing to practice like this, changes came by themselves, mostly around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. Things seem to change when one feels that the day is over and the night is coming. The change comes suddenly in a single moment, but I didn't take it as something special. I just saw it as an effect of the practice itself. I didn't give a thought to anyone, and in the monastery there wasn't anything happening, so things couldn't have happened in relation to anyone or anything external. I was living in real seclusion and kept on practicing. When there was suffering, I looked at it, following, observing, and watching it, knowing its arising and knowing it as it was there, but I didn't get deluded into taking it as something special. I saw everything simply as an expression of suffering, suffering that had arisen and had to cease due to its transient nature. I came to the point of feeling only halfway in control of myself. I asked myself if I was going insane, but that couldn't be because I was fully aware, so I kept on doing the practice by myself. Lungpa Cha then announced that the monks and novices should have a break from morning and evening chanting. This came at just the right time for me. He reminded everybody that when there was no morning or evening chanting, they should spend their time like practitioners. Now there weren't any communal activities except for water hauling from the well, which we used to do in those days, hauling and carrying water together. I never spoke with anyone when carrying the water. When it was time, we would simply take the poles and tins for carrying, help each other fetch the water from the well, and then carry it to fill up the jars in the restrooms for flushing the toilets or to fill up the drinking water. Afterwards, I would go have a shower at one of the bathing places and would then carry on with walking or sitting meditation. At times, while I was doing walking meditation, it started raining and I was tempted to stop, but then I thought, just let the rain rain, I will keep on walking. Things get wet, but they also become dry again. One shouldn't even be thinking about whether it is going to be sunny or rainy. I don't know where the faith I had came from. I had no worries about what was going to happen with me. I was fully dedicated and pleased with what I was doing. There was continuous interest and motivation. I didn't shy away from possible obstacles. I wouldn't question or analyze where I was at, or when I was doing walking meditation. Usually, when doing walking meditation, I wouldn't wear my upper robe in the formal way, but would wear only the small shoulder cloth, the angsa. From time to time, I robed up completely, somehow afraid that my standards were insufficient, putting on my upper robe and laying the outer robe, sangati, over my shoulder. It's 8:47. It's quite long. This may be halfway. Okay.